Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. HRN is food radio supported by you. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. We've been making cheese in Wisconsin since before we were even a state, which may be one reason why we win so many awards for it. It's what happens when a whole state dreams in cheese. Find your next favorite cheese at wisconsincheese.com.
You're listening to Fields, the podcast. I'm Wyth Marshall.
And I'm Melissa Metrick.
On Fields, we're bringing you the stories of people who are working in the world of urban agriculture. For money, for fun, for art, for justice, to feed the hungry, to green the city, or to uncover its history.
In each episode of Fields, we'll delve into one kind of food that's grown in cities, one technology used to grow, or one project that teaches us something about our relationship to farming in urban environments.
Moreover, we'll investigate all the whys behind getting up in the morning and working as a farmer in the city today.
You don't need to be a farmer to enjoy this podcast, or even a foodie.
We're going to tell fascinating stories and break down the realities and possible futures of urban farming to their elements. Hey, welcome back to Fields, the unfinished story of urban agriculture. I'm Wyth Marshall, and as always, I'm joined by...
I'm Melissa Metrick.
And today we have a very special guest. It's Henry Obispo. Hey, Henry, how's it going, man?
Hi, guys. How are you?
Good. Thank you so much for joining us, despite the cold. It's kind of turning cold now.
It's freezing.
Yeah. Recording this in mid-November. We're very excited to see you twice in one day, in fact. So we're, you know, in the Bronx, now we're here in Brooklyn.
Yeah.
A lot of urban ag stuff going on, lots to talk about. Maybe, Melissa, do you think we should just allow, you know, ask Henry to sort of introduce himself first? What do you think?
Yeah, that'd be great. Okay. So, Henry, if you could just, like, really quickly introduce yourself and, yeah.
Beautiful. Yeah. So I'm Henry Obispo, and I am a child of the Bronx, raised in the Bronx since the age of five. I was born in the Dominican Republic. Why that's important, it's not just because of it's my, I would say, my story, but because it's linked to essentially what I'm doing now. It is these worlds that I end up inhabiting that really form my way forward. And so I've been working in the community in the South Bronx specifically for over a decade, creating solutions and really thinking about my passion, which is nature and food, and how that can be a catalyst for change and empowerment and transformation.
Was there like a first initial project or something that kind of got you more into it or got you into this field in general?
I would say that yes, but it wasn't specific. Mm-hmm. I had been living in Brazil for some time, and I actually, that's where I decided that I wanted to be an entrepreneur, but really a social entrepreneur, because I really cared about people and the planet and communities. And so I started to think about what that would be. And it was upon my return that I started canvassing my neighborhood and the South Bronx to see what it was that I wanted to connect with, what needed my attention and my help. And it's really there that I connect to that, you know, that childhood in the Dominican Republic, because at a very early age, I was connected to plants and nature and fruits. I was obsessed with fruits, and I was obsessed with food and how you could transform a plant into something edible and all of these things. So I started cooking very early. At the age of three, I was already cooking and creating things in the backyard and like...
Were you helping garden, like kind of participating with the family, like tending plants?
You know? Yeah. So it was almost like involuntary. because it was happening, and my family in the Dominican Republic had a parcel of land that most families have in sort of like the semi-rural areas. And they're called conucos. And these conucos are indigenous in terms of how people plant, in almost like a hill of sorts. And it's I would call it a Taíno technology, an indigenous technology of agriculture. And so my family had that as well. And so we would go there to harvest. We would go there to essentially get our weekly tubers or whatnot. And it's really that connection to that and the food that allowed me now to focus when I was in the South Bronx, to focus around these ideas because it's what was very dear to me. And so as a result of that, I partnered with local nonprofits and was able to get a small grant from the USDA. In that partnership was like $25,000. But that $25,000 allowed me to canvas the entire South Bronx from a solutions-based approach. And it was incredible because I ended up connecting with pretty much everyone that had been working in food systems, all levels, and learning what had been done before me, what had been happening at the moment. And that is how I was able for those 6 months to really look at all this information and see where the sort of the holes were. And my job essentially was to look at all this information, engaging with all stakeholders, clergy, elected officials, business owners, activists, everybody, and seeing where those gaps were.
When was this?
This was 2014.
So about a decade ago, yeah. Basically, you sort of began the journey of, okay, I'm going to be an entrepreneur specifically related to food and ag. And specifically, you chose, like, I'm going to go home. Like, I'm going to do it in the Bronx, for the Bronx. And you started with this research project, which was USDA funded. So we'll talk about sort of what businesses you developed. But just to set the picture, also for listeners who aren't in New York or don't know the Bronx that well, I mean, the Bronx is amazing in terms of food for a number of reasons. It's home to New York Botanical Garden, which is, you know, the supreme institution for botanical knowledge, you know, in the Northeast,
in the world.
Yeah. I mean, it's up there. It's like with, you know, Kew Gardens and whatnot. And it's also home of Hunts Point and the food distribution hub, through which, you know, a fourth of all food, but something like, you know, the overwhelming majority of fresh produce is passing every day. So whatever we're eating, a lot of it and most of the fresh stuff is stopping off in the South Bronx. And people don't necessarily know that and how critical this large area of food distribution is that's active all day long. And has this wild rhythm where at night, you know, trucks are loading to go to grocery stores to, you know, be stocked so that in the morning you buy food and restaurants can buy food and et cetera. So I think the idea that like the Bronx isn't just a place where people live, it's also where New York City is really getting its food. And there, you know, there's also an abundance of community gardens, of course. But I think again, it's like a very special area, to have decided like, all right, this is home. This is where I'm going to kind of jump into starting a business.
So yeah.
I guess the next question would be, what did you do with that knowledge? What did you decide to pursue?
So it was a lot of information. Also because you're coming in with new ideas, but, are they new really? Mm. And so it was really questioning a lot of the ideas I had, and understanding that I was really standing on shoulders of people that for generations had been looking and working to create solutions and bring forth change, and that they had essentially done that and pushed essentially the needle forward a tremendous amount. And so it's learning that. Right, which is very, very important because you can't start thinking that you're going to be the savior of everything from a very sort of like egoic place. You have to acknowledge what's there and what's been there. And so it was really that understanding that really grounded me. And I understood that I had to, if I was going to step into this, I was going to build on that. Mm-hmm. And ways that, you know, I did that was by partnering with these institutions that were looking to find solutions. And I just happened to have a specific perspective because of my lived experiences and because of how I connect certain dots that I was now, and the level of energy that I bring, which is very much so, you know, Aries energy that's very forward and very entrepreneurial in that way, and it's to get things done. And so with all that, we were able to develop and launch Born Juice, which is a zero waste juice company that focused really on nutrition and nutritionally dense foods for the community, as well as education around food, but also planet. And it was a really novel idea, not the fact that it was a juice company, but that we were doing all of these things with it. And it, the beauty of that, which I didn't know at that point, was that all of this engagement that I did for 6 months, I thought that I was in many ways collecting information, but what I really was doing was building relationships. And I only really realized it when I launched Born Juice, and these institutions now were coming to me and saying, hey, what, we heard this, we heard you're launching something, we want to be a part of it. And that was a complete surprise to me. And that is essentially the model for Born Juice. We thought it was going to be, you know, us preparing juices and selling it to customers, et cetera. But it ended up being that the business model was us creating these experiential components for institutions and schools. And also we would engage with individuals, but it was we would be hired for all of these things. And it would really came about by way of that initial engagement. Mm-hmm. That wasn't a business model that we would have even thought about, because we were thinking traditionally, you know, one-on-one customer to that type of relationship. But that right. was really incredible.
So that was the social entrepreneurship part, is you weren't yeah. just selling juice. You were building experiences around learning about food, and you're trying to work with people already in the area, you know, so it's not sort of didactic, like telling people what to think, but kind of working with them, understanding what they want.
Yeah. Or being like, you know, I've heard there's a problem in this neighborhood. Mm. I'm going to fix it, or I'm going to come in and right. give this solution. Instead, it's actually going to the community and being like, hey, what is going on here? Already being a part of the community, asking like, where can we help in these certain aspects? And also going to community leaders, community activists, building those relationships. I always feel like that's key in working with any community. It's like actually going there in a very respectful way, and especially if you're a part of it,
yeah.
and just being like, hey, what's yeah. going on?
And yeah. so imagine this is going to apply, I think, if I'm jumping ahead, to the urban ag story as well, where you're going to sort of take this same approach with growing food. But may I ask, just as a quick follow-up,
yeah.
and sorry, Melissa, if you have another question, yeah. please jump in after, but what were you sourcing when you launched the juice company? Where was, you know, the material for the juices coming from? And is that something, you know, is that something you were thinking about already, or, yeah. or did that sort of shift over time?
Yeah. So initially, you know, it was thinking about nutrition. And how can we focus on health? And then it evolved to very soon the sourcing and you know, what is this? Is the produce organic? What is the cost for this? How can we mitigate that? What is the connection to agriculture? What about these institutions that we're dealing also locally with produce? Could we connect with them? Could we build partnerships around that? And it was a lot of questions, and we didn't have all the answers for these questions that would arise. And so, but we did ended up partnering with Grow NYC. We ended up partnering with Bronx Health Reach and other organizations that were focused on produce, delivering, connecting people by way of also CSAs, having relationships with the Corbin Hill very early on around these ideas about on distribution. And so then we realized that why should we outsource that if we could build our own farm and maybe source from there? But how could that be done if this is a city? And sort of thinking of all of these things led us to start dreaming and start talking to more people. And it was really then that we ended up connecting with other nonprofits that actually could leverage space and could leverage other resources and grants, et cetera, because obviously we didn't have those means. And by way of that and building those relationships, we were able to launch a farm on Bruckner Boulevard in partnership with a local nonprofit. It was a very small farm, and that farm essentially created that pilot aspect for this juice. And then beyond that, once we started developing that idea, we realized that with our partnerships, there was another opportunity to even extend it further. And that is when we started thinking about this idea of the restaurant cooperative and launching the United Business Cooperative to connect local immigrant mom and pop business owners, specifically in the food business, with fresh produce that was hyper-local. Because, you know, when you're thinking about distribution, why not connect to the people that are already there, the stakeholders, and some of them that may not be doing so well because they're not being prized in by either the city or the community. They're not looked at, you know, as a sort of a novel business, but they are stakeholders. They've been there for 15, 20 years. And our engagement was to connect with them and to be able to bring this produce to them as well. So that was the start of that led to now other ideas, which that other idea is the Bronx Salad Initiative that I can definitely talk more about that. But that's the initiative that really launched everything, and it's the precursor to Reborn Farms.
Well, yeah.
So it's really interesting just to hear you go into this, how you all kind of traveled into the local produce section. So this pilot farm and then finding or helping or this restaurant cooperative that would kind of help them get more local produce and probably affordable local produce. Because whenever I think of local produce, for some reason, I think of it as expensive. And it's like for a mom and pop, especially that's been there for a long time, how do you, give them healthy, fresh produce, but that's all local and inexpensive? Because I know with restaurants in general, it's like they're line of operation and you know, profit and that stuff isn't that the bar, you know, like it's not that high. So it's like, and also to try something new, which seems like that would also be like people, especially if they've been doing a business for a while, you know, how do you get folks to try something new?
I'm having flashbacks right now. Because it's like, you know what, it is the most rewarding thing, but it's the hardest work to organize people. Community organizing is the hardest work, like, on the planet.
Yeah.
Because to your point, to get someone to engage with someone, to not just to say yes to something that doesn't know you. They don't know you. You're coming to them because you want to create something that would benefit the community, and they are part of it, and they're, you know, pillars in the community. And so for them to accept you because they've been battered by so many things, whether it's like the city creating barriers, these are also people that didn't speak the language, or, you know, their status may not have been legal, et cetera. So there are a lot of ways that people have been in this industry abused. Mm-hmm. And so they're, many times they're not trusting. And so if you're coming to them with solutions, they're always, you know, there's a there's a wall there that you have to be able to break down. And the way that you do that is by continuous engagement. And sometimes it would be a week engaging with someone, with a restaurant owner, and they would be okay with that and they would want to be part of this program because it sounded really incredible. And then sometimes it took 6 months to engage the other one. It took us engaging with them every week or every other week so that they know that we actually really mean it and that we're, you know, we're not here to extract or anything like that. And so it's the commitment to that, whether it happens immediately or it doesn't. And that's the thing. And that's why a lot of work doesn't move forward, because it's almost like people assume that it's going to happen right away. Mm. And that's just not the case. And to get people to organize around these ideas, especially this idea of hyperlocal produce and access, because it's very expensive. So the way that we started engaging them was to think about collective purchasing. Because if they pay a premium individually, what would happen if you collectively engaged? And that's the game changer. So that's how we engaged these ideas around collective purchasing.
Yeah, and I just want to underline, I think it's so cool, and I think this is one of these lessons we can draw from Born and Reborn and broadly thinking about, you know, urban food systems and what solutions can work. Is it's not like you made a quote-unquote solution and then brought it to people and shopped it around. Like, hey, here's this local lettuce I'm growing, for example. You were working with people to collectivize them as cooperatives, you know, mom-and-pop restaurants, to help them, you know, modernize and understand the city. I know, you know, we've heard this from bodegas and my research, you know, the inspectors come and they fine you because something is out of place and people don't necessarily totally understand. They're not getting a lot of support, so they don't feel trusting. They feel targeted.
Okay.
Yeah, they feel targeted. There's just like a
sometimes
attack.
They are.
Yeah.
So I think it's very different to go to with that pain point and work with them in a different way as opposed to just selling them a product, because then you're getting that buy-in and you know, collective agreement, and it takes longer, but then it leads to
solid. Once it's done, it's the most solid thing. Like, the relationships are forever.
Because people have their own aha moment about the produce, about local growing, et cetera, whatever it is, and they can learn because they're interested. You're not kind of trying to tell them something they don't want to hear.
Yeah.
So anyway, exactly. I think that's super cool. So can you tell us a little about, I always get the name wrong, but
the United Business Cooperative.
United Business Cooperative. See, why can't I remember that?
it's a long name.
No, it's good. It's just I know it's important, and I think maybe that transitions into the Bronx Salad or
yeah, it's connected. Yeah. So the United Business Cooperative, man, it's something that came together very organically, and I was in many ways assisting. That's how I came to be. It started before me, meaning that several of these restaurant owners and food business entrepreneurs started having conversations with each other and started saying, hey, I feel like I'm being harassed, or I feel like, you know, a group is tapping into me, or the city is being unfair. And they started these conversations. And so they brought these conversations to one of our partners locally. And within that conversation, there was a greater one, which was, why don't you guys bring these ideas together of what you could do? And maybe we can help you. And it was really that started this group. And so I just came to really organize them, because many of them didn't speak the language. And so I started, because I also had launched Born Juice and I was embedded in the food world like that, and I had all of these partners that I could be of service to this group of people, which were when I was essentially presiding over it or stewarding it. There were 45 restaurants that were part of it.
That's a lot.
It was just so impactful because they they came together themselves. And then from there, you know, the word spreads because they, if there's buy-in, then it's like those walls are down also. So a lot of them started joining because they trusted that, you know, their friends who were also in this business were a part of it. And they said, it's legit. Or actually also like, oh, we're forming it. So it really started like that. And my role was to really organize and help organize and to steward that project in terms of like financial access, like access to money so that we could provide small grants, help with menu development when it comes to thinking about health. But also my, you know, my point of view is always planet. So it's like, okay, how are we thinking about these ideas of sustainability before like anyone was really thinking about this in like this world? That was, it's my passion. And so I wanted to bring that there. So it's also developing zero waste, I would say, dishes from, you know, we would see what they would create. And then we would say, okay, you're discarding this. What if we could create something with this? And so we would bring chefs, or I myself would engage them, and we would create dishes from things that would normally be discarded. And then, you know, when it comes to their bottom line, now it's helping them because they don't. They have a total new dish or two dishes that was really based on what they already had. So it was rethinking all of these things and tapping into that, helping them with their space, with the physical aspects of their space that could be more viable for them. And all really thinking about helping them and strengthen their business and their finances, but also to maintain and remain culturally relevant to them, not to whitewash them or like get them ready for, you know, because, you know, the South Bronx at that point started to gentrify. And so it was with that in mind, saying, hey, if we can strengthen these businesses, they won't be kicked out eventually. And so it was also from that place that we engaged the cooperative.
Right. Like if they didn't change, they were going to die, essentially get gobbled up. So you formed it. It sounds almost like a mini Mondragon. You know, you had this whole network of people coming together and rethinking top to bottom with the three P's in mind, you know, their businesses. So they're, it was still within the market. They're still trying to make money and actually make more money, but in part by, you know, using, having less waste and being sort of kinder to each other in the community and thinking about that. So very cool. And that leads into the Bronx Salad.
Which
is a good name. And it's like, even if you don't know what it is, I feel like people are meaning
Bronx
in.
The Bronx Salad. I mean, the Bronx Salad is the new Cobb Salad or the new Caesar Salad.
Right. You're going to order it. You're going to go around the world. You're going to go to like Hong Kong and be like, I would like the Bronx Salad, please.
That's exactly what.
I could kind of actually see that in like Hong Kong. Right, like,
So, it's an incredible story because out of, you know, all the work that we were doing, also, again, the institutions or the community and the organizations would hear about it or would be, you know, involved in some way. And that's how we went into partnership with Bronx Health Reach, who is connected to a wide, I would say, coalition of 70 organizations that ended up partnering also in this project, this initiative. And it really was thinking about what if we created something that would be culturally relevant, that would bring health, that would also allow the Bronx to tell a story that was very positive, because it's an incredible place and people should think of it as such. And so it dawned on myself and the organization I was working with that it should be a dish. And this dish, then that's when the name came, the Bronx Salad. And it was like an aha moment. And it stuck. And we're like, yeah, that's what we should create. And we should connect the farm to this dish, source it locally, and showcase this hyper-local aspect of it. Obviously, not all the ingredients are grown there because there are tropical ingredients in the salad also. But what if we could showcase that component? And what if we could connect all these other things to it? What if we thought of it as a system? That was really the idea. So there's a dish, and it took us like 5-6 months, 13 iterations to develop in partnership with chefs. Also,
that's a long time to develop a dish.
When was this again? What year have we moved forward?
From 2015 to 2019.
Okay, so up to the pandemic. So
yes.
And what are the ingredients?
So the ingredients, greens, right? We ended up being flexible with that because you could have your lettuce or whatever greens you have.
Arugula.
Yeah, all of the above. There was avocado. The idea is that for the iterations, we had 13 iterations, and it took us that long because we surveyed over 300 people. And the people spoke, and they said that that's what they wanted.
They're like, we don't want kale.
Yeah, they said that.
Yeah, I know. Well, I don't know,
but they did, because we had one of the iterations was that.
Yeah.
And we learned so much of just like assuming. When you assume for people that go into communities and assume like, yeah, just because you have good intentions, that doesn't translate well. And that doesn't mean it's going to be successful or that people are going to receive it. The good intentions are, you know, are great, but that's not how things should work.
So you're doing market research, like you're bringing groups of people with the chefs and Bronx Health Reach and your team, and you're kind of giving them salad, watching them eat salad, having them rate it.
Yeah.
Well, but I'm curious about like, what are the culturally relative ingredients?
Well, yeah, I was going to say, let's do the final drum roll, like the day when everyone is like, high fives, we got it. Yeah. What is in the salad?
So, yeah, so we did all that, all the iterations, right? And by that, we came to the dish by these surveys and by these tastings. And like I said, it was greens, some of what we grew at the farm, but also from Grow NYC that we sourced. So there's avocado, black beans, corn, red onion, and mango.
Nice.
Yeah. So it was this
tropical. Like mangoes, the like little
tart. Yeah. So there's the tropicals. You know, there's some cilantro there as well. And there were about 8 ingredients in the dressing. That were also, you know, we wanted to make it vegan friendly. But the idea behind the dish was that it was culturally relevant in that the black beans, the corn component, there's a large Mexican population and Latin population in the South Bronx. And so for them, the way that we wanted to introduce this dish is that it's a complete dish. It's not a side dish.
Right.
So what you eat here and what you consume here with these greens that are local and these other components that you may have or may not, but are familiar with by way of your lineage, et cetera, this is a familiar dish to you. And so as such, you're not averse to it, right? But it's also a complete meal. Because it has the component, the protein component, it's got the carbs component, it's got the sweet, it's got the sour component, it's got all of these aspects. And that's what we were in many ways educating on, which is health, but don't think of this as a side thing. Think of it as a main dish.
Yeah. What is the carb? Is that just like part of the bean or like
what? Well, the bean has corn. The corn has carb, corn, and the mango.
Yeah.
Whoa. Okay.
Yeah. And the protein, the beans, obviously.
Yeah.
And some of the greens have carbs as well. And the avocado, right?
Yeah. And the fat, the avocado's got fat.
Is the mango ripe or not that ripe?
Ripe.
Okay.
Yes.
I don't know why
Okay. I mean, for that population, it better be ripe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I know there's certain, like, communities that...
Yeah.
Well, like Thai salads have like green papaya,
yeah,
which is the base of all Thai salad. Yum.
Yeah.
But it's a very, and it's really good, but it's a very different, like now I'm used to, because my wife happens to be Thai, but until I like went there and ate a lot of salad where it was like, we're just shredding papaya all day.
Yeah.
And it's just not the same as greens, and it's a very different kind of mouthfeel and all that. But I realized I think I make a lot of Bronx salads at home, minus the corn. I must admit I'm not a huge corn fan, but the other things, I feel like I eat a Bronx salad fairly often, maybe swap out something else for mango sometimes, other fruits, but I love fruit and salad. I just never thought of it that way. I think I'm in my head, I'm going to start calling it, like, for lunch, I'm having a Bronx salad.
But you know what also makes it, aside from the dressing, which is, like, incredible.
Can you tell us what's in it, or is that a secret?
Some of it is a secret, because we may be bottling it soon.
Cool.
Yeah. but you know,
Bronx dressing.
Yeah. And so the beauty of this Bronx salad was that to top it off, you know, there are all of these components with the salad, the sweet, the sour, the greens, the dressing. And then there was one thing that, you know, was missing on the salad. And that is the crunch, right? And so it's just, you want to engage everyone with this mouthfeel and this, you know, all of these things that actually when you finish eating, you say, yeah, I am satisfied.
Right.
Because all of these things have been hit, all of these points. And then the crunch component was, I don't know if you want to guess, for the population, it wouldn't be croutons, it wouldn't be any of these things or seeds or whatever, but they wanted the plantain chips. So it's topped with plantain chips.
Yeah.
And now it became something that's like, oh, this speaks to me. This is culturally for me. Because everyone, whether it's the African population there, most of the immigrant populations, et cetera, in the South Bronx, engages with plantains.
They're so good.
Yeah.
They're so much better than the potato chips. I'm saying it.
Of course. I mean,
I'm saying it out loud.
We've known that since forever.
You can say that.
So, yeah.
I don't know, maybe you like potato chips a lot.
You know, that's how we comprised this dish. And it was so incredibly well received that we rolled it out in the 45 restaurants. Because we thought the idea that, you know, we should, not just because it was a dish that obviously we worked on for so long, but what if, you know, these ideas of distribution are already there, the mom and pop restaurants are already there, invest in them so that they could, you know, and like have this livelihood and be a part of whatever movements are going on. And so it was with that in mind that we rolled them out and also created a marketing campaign for them so that they can gain traction and see that it was viable to actually sell a salad like this.
Right.
And so we got them interviews, we got them press and all of these things to show that and to gain traction for their businesses. And that was really, really powerful. We also rolled it out in 9 elementary schools.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, along with small gardens at their schools. And then every year they would go into competition to see who made the best Bronx salad based on what they grew.
I like that. I like
incredible.
That. Yeah.
I was the judge for like two of those competitions. yeah, it was incredible to like have kids say, you know, grow a lot of these ingredients and then create the salad and then compete. Come on.
Yeah. No, it's fun. You're asking the community and then you're raising this dish to parody with, like, if you think of like a chili cook-off or like a burger cookout, it's like, it's not saying those things could never happen. You're just saying, well, you could also do this with salad and have this amazing, you know, full meal that has all these great ingredients. Like you said,
it hits, and one thing you'll know is that, you know, in the Bronx, we are very proud people. And so you name it the Bronx salad, we are Bronx centered. And we're going to represent that, you know, we're going to be very proud of that. Oh, that's the Bronx salad. Yeah. Like I'm from the Bronx, you know, I love my neighborhood or my borough and I'm going to represent this, you know?
Yeah. We were talking before taping about people wearing shirts that just say like Brooklyn. So now I'm picturing you, I don't know if you made any shirts that just say like Bronx salad or just.
So we had that, but you know, but it was legit, not like the you know, the other ones we were talking about.
Yeah.
These were homegrown.
Yeah.
This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. There's a reason when you think of Wisconsin, you think cheese. Cheese is a huge part of Wisconsin's history and future. In Wisconsin, the state of cheese, the tradition of cheesemaking excellence began 180 years ago, before Wisconsin was recognized as a state. Immigrants traveled to settle in this lush green hills of Wisconsin, bringing their cheesemaking traditions with them. These storied skills combined with the freshest milk available created a cheesemaking culture that is uniquely Wisconsin. Wisconsin's 1,200 cheesemakers, many of whom are third and fourth generation, continue to pass on old world traditions while adopting modern innovations in cheesemaking craftsmanship. Find your next favorite cheese at wisconsincheese.com.
Well, yeah. So I don't want to rush you, just in mindful of time. So this is up to the pandemic. So you have Born Juice, you have the United Business Cooperative, and you have the Bronx Salad Initiative. You partner with Bronx Health Reach, all these restaurants. So, you know, what happens next, and what leads you to, you know, focus on urban agriculture in that aspect? And I'm not saying these other things have gone away, just, you know, kind of catching us up a little.
Yeah. So
bringing farming in.
Yeah. So it's really out of that. I mean, it's all these years of there was always a vision of scale, but I understood that I had to build and really be immersed in whatever it was that I was a part of at the moment. But I needed to learn that route because it all actually came together. And because I understood that in the ways that I, you know, naturally would put things together, I understood that there was a trajectory and I needed to move accordingly to develop these ideas and these relationships that will lead to this greater scale. And it was really thinking in those terms, not knowing what that would look like, but knowing that that was the way forward, that I connected with people and created these initiatives. And then the Bronx Salad showed us that scale was possible and it was really impactful. And it's really from there that we took the learnings, the amazing things, the things that worked really, really well, the things that didn't work well, and just all the knowledge from that for those 4 years, because it was a 4-year pilot. It was just very hands-on, and built the scaling of that, which is Reborn Farms. Reborn Farms is, you know, the ethos is that decade of work, and all of that, the amalgamation of all of that into Reborn Farms as a system. Also, just the way that we engaged the Bronx Salad, which was this borough-wide connection that we created. It was also with that we created Reborn Farms, essentially to build a decentralized system, food system.
Yeah, so what is a farm as a decentralized system?
So the farm as a decentralized system operates very much so... thinks of itself in a very much so centered way, right? Like you center solutions where the needs are, as opposed to a trickle down idea that, you know, is usually how our food system is everything's trickle down, or there's the assumption that it something gets to you, where the Bronx is the best example of actually trickle down is not, like, it's not real, it's not true, because it's not true that things get to you or that food eventually gets to you in the way that it should, even when you have the largest market in the world at your doorstep. It's not how it works.
It's so crazy because, like, Hunt's Point right there.
Yeah. But that's, and so I think part of what you're saying is that there's a lot of urban food insecurity in New York City, and especially in the Bronx compared to the other boroughs, despite the fact that obviously there's tremendous wealth in New York City, and we're in the middle of a region with abundant farmland and the sort of home of, you know, the urban agriculture movement. And the Bronx specifically is where all the food's passing through. So you would think between all these different things, you know, a democratically held city council and mayoral, you know, administrations year after year, you know, someone would at some point would like figure that out. And yet there's massive food insecurity in the Bronx. So, you should put in, you're the expert, right? But this is from like the social science perspective. It's like, wow, those numbers, like,
yeah,
something's going
crazy
on here, right? Yeah.
Yeah. And it's generational.
Yeah.
It's so connected to so many things, to redlining,
yeah,
to just disinvestment,
right,
to white flight, to everything, to the Bronx, you know, having to rebuild itself by community, after arsoning and just all this history that the Bronx has had to endure, and just be so resilient, right? And done such an incredible job to just build so much beauty from all of these things, these social ills that have fallen on it. And so it is from that standpoint, because that's the reality on the ground, that we get to engage in community in a very direct way and see that actually is building direct solutions. So, for example, our first farm on public housing is taking a lot of the things that we've done into account and now scaling that there and thinking about distribution there, is thinking about this hyper-local component, is thinking about vertical integration when it comes to what could be produced there to have greater value for this idea of workforce, but also educational aspects, but going even beyond that, like ideas of ownership, right? How can we really build an economic engine, essentially, by way of food? And these are the ways that we think are the best ways possible for that to happen. But the most important one is that you have to center yourself in the community. And the community has to dictate what it wants, what it needs. And, you know, it's not an... You can't come from the outside to, again, you know, that's the example of the surveying, and assume, you know, there's a lot of assumption. This is also why there are so many, just people are bringing quote unquote solutions, but they're not really solutions. They're, you know, they're dreamed of in people's heads,
yeah,
and they mean really well, but they also, that's part of the reason why things don't change. Because it's not embedded in the community. And so our model is to actually, you know, flip that on its head and center the community.
So I'm curious about, like, if you could explain how this farm works, the techniques, the kind of like, who's actually like managing the farm, working the farm, what are you guys growing? In general.
So we're actually launching it in January.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, okay.
Yeah.
All right.
So, but we've piloted in the, during COVID, we ran a couple of pilots, mm-hmm, there. And also in partnership with NYRP.
Okay.
Are you familiar with
yeah,
the New York Restoration Project?
Yeah. Yeah.
And their farms.
Okay.
Clearly theirs is soil based. Their gardens are soil based, and ours are hydroponic. And so we ran the programs for close to 2 years with the NYRP partnership, and then ran a couple of pilots at the rooftop a year ago to now launch it the beginning of next year.
Yeah,
I just find it so smart, like how you're piloting it all out first. Like, it just seems very well thought of, and how it's almost like experimenting, like figuring it out, like using that wording of like piloting, seeing how the I don't know. This is just from what I'm hearing in my perspective, but like how the community is engaging, how they're responding, like this whole kind of aspect. So it's like, it's not rushing into things. It's like, okay, yeah, we're going to do this smaller project and then build this larger project out of it. And we're going to see how it goes. Yeah. You know, like just, I really like that idea of like pilot experiment, like.
Well, and if I can add the historical component to the space you're describing, because I think I've been to this space every year since 2016 or 2017. I mean, it's a really interesting space and it has a somewhat interesting history, and it would make sense given this, I think, that you would take your time for the reasons you're stating and why you're emphasizing the community aspect. And this is not, before I say anything, to knock the previous models, but just that, hey, they're not operating now, right? So you had entrepreneurs from outside of the city coming into this space. It's a NYCHA community, this beautiful, I think it's LEED Platinum or at least LEED Gold, right, certified building. I think it's LEED Platinum. So it's meaning it's like really sustainable, modern urban design. And on the top, they put this high-tech greenhouse. So for hydroponics, using the sun and then, you know, artificial light to reinforce in the cold months in the Northeast, and you would grow, you know, leafy greens primarily, but also squash blossoms, whatever. And it was run by these entrepreneurs. They were, for whatever reason, they brought on agriculture consulting. We just had on, you know, Henry Gordon Smith. And they were running it for this other group for a long time, on and off. They had different levels of, you know, 100% built out to whatever, you know, 3/4 of the space built out. But they were selling, I think, to restaurants primarily. They were giving away a lot to people in the building. You might be able to speak their model. I don't remember exactly without my notes. But eventually, for whatever reason, and again, we could ask them why, but they've wound that down. I mean, it's not, you know, their consultancy. They don't run farms directly like that, I don't think. And basically, no one was using it. And so you had this amazing space where no one was activating. No one was bringing local food into the community. And the earlier models of primarily sort of selling to restaurants in Manhattan, maybe that's part of it. I mean, maybe this is a question, I guess, to formulate as a question. You know, what is your vision for, like, you're going to grow food in the South Bronx? And I think part of what you're describing, correct me if I'm wrong, is that you're training students who want to learn these skills, you know, high tech, modern horticulture, who are in the South Bronx, who wouldn't necessarily otherwise be able to learn that anywhere. I mean, this isn't the kind of skill you can easily figure out. Maybe Melissa, you can speak to this too, right? How do you get education as an urban farmer? So I think it's an interesting project for a number of reasons. And some of the slowness is your thoughtfulness as an entrepreneur, social entrepreneur. And some of it, I think, is you're watching these other projects happen and thinking about, you know, what would I do differently? What can I learn from what they're doing?
Well, so. And how much indoor growing and these and like indoor companies and greenhouses in general has changed within the past 5 years, which we've talked about in other shows of just like, you know, what is going on in this hydroponics indoor world in general, and what, how are these businesses, are they, you know, are they still able to produce, are they still able to run?
Yeah, what's the right use of the technology if it's not something where you're going to make bajillions of dollars growing lettuce, which, you know, spoiler, no one's ever made that much money growing lettuce, then maybe that doesn't mean you just don't do it. It's like, how do we do it? What's the right way to do it? And I think that's where you're bringing a somewhat different vision of, well, okay, what would that look like if, you know? So I don't know, Henry, if there's a lot there, but if you want to sort of just speak a little to the model or dream.
You're assessing things really well. And I would say, you know, to the, what you were saying earlier, it's, and what you're alluding to, a lot of it is because community is not the center of a lot of these projects. It's just not, it's an afterthought.
Yep.
And then you try to sort of like build a tentacle that's community that fulfills something, because you may have these other pressures that are like forcing you to be a specific thing. But also you don't come from that. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean that you can't service that. You should, but also it may not be natural for you because that's not your world.
Right, you're fighting an uphill battle to engage with the community. If you're coming from outside,
well,
you're
doing and the it community for marketing knows, or PR. You know, like the community knows. It's like, what are you guys doing? Why are you here?
And
like,
you know, to your point of, you know, when certain projects bring people from the outside or whatever, what could happen? There may not be synergy. And then part of the reason why, you know, we've been thoughtful and methodical about things is because it's a privilege to be in community. It's a privilege. And it is the privilege of a lifetime to be given an opportunity to think about things and to say, oh, okay, try here, or let's do this, or let's partner. That's a privilege. And I take it as such, 100%. And it is that allows me to iterate and to think about things and to say, oh, well, let's partner, let's pilot, because there is that. And I see it like that. And it is from that privilege. I don't minimize that. And that's what allows us to think like that and be experimental and or try things out, because the way that we're looking to design things is that there are certain pressures that we are opting out of, right? That doesn't mean that, you know, moving forward, as you expand certain things, that you won't have certain pressures that are economic, et cetera. But initially, the idea was to not have those pressures, which makes everything really, really hard also, right? Because if you have a bunch of money, then you go and do something. But that doesn't mean you're going to do it right.
Well, yeah. And you have to answer to whoever who is giving you that money.
Right.
Yeah.
And who is your boss?
Yeah.
Yeah. And I just think there's this matrix you're drawing, which is really, really smart, which is that community is a strength. And the slowness, the methodical approach is a strength. The power of having these many voices, these many proverbial chefs in the kitchen is a strength. It's not a deficit. Now, of course, the deficit is in the real world, in the market economy, you know, capital. So the lack of capital is the sort of downside. But on the flip side, all these well-financed farms that we've been talking about, talking to, you know, this industrial, what I call the financial industrial vision for indoor farming, their strength is they have the capital on hand.
They have that VC money.
But that's short term, right? Because long term, they're lacking all these connections, as you said, right? Synergies. They're lacking ways to turn that money into some longer term engagement. If you think of it, you know, at the level of culture, they're not really changing minds. So they put a product on the shelves. If I'm a consumer, there's a million kinds of lettuce. Most people don't care. Lettuce is a commodity. I mean, they just sort of, they buy whatever. Some people have been successful. We've talked about it many times on the show. You know, small hold successfully turned oyster mushrooms in the Northeast, at least in the urban U.S., into something kind of new. Even if you could have gotten oyster mushrooms before, it was like, oh, this is like a branded experience. But I think a lot of that VC-backed world has struggled to find the synergies to connect tentacularly with the community in any kind of honest way. Some people have, but you know, most haven't. So I think you're just sort of comparing these two modes. Maybe that's a simplification, but I think it's helpful sometimes to see it that way and say, no, like, I love what you said. You're fighting from a place of strength with your strengths. You're not trying to, you know, it's not parallel. You're not fighting from the same way that a VC-backed firm would be, you know, constructing a business model.
Yeah, there's this idea of currency. Right. Mm. We're talking about like financial, which is in this paradigm, in this world, that's how things sort of work, right? Allow you to create and to hire and to do all these things. But there are a lot of currencies, and the downfall of a lot of ideas or people, et cetera, is that they only engage in one currency. Mm. And there are limitless amounts of currencies. And when you rise to that, you see not just quote unquote opportunities, you just see the value of so many things. But it's about that. It takes you understanding that there's value in something and that that is an exchange and a currency. And these currencies operate in other ways that are not necessarily transactional like these other ones. And these can solidify certain things that can weather a storm and could actually penetrate certain things and areas and just, you know, take your vision even further, because they take that currency takes it personal. Okay. And that's a different type of engagement. And it's that, you know, it's not focused on capital, but it's a currency that, you know, in this capitalist world, we don't value like that. But they are there. We just dispose them, or, you know, they're just not relevant. Whereas where I come from, that's the only currency we have. Mm. And we understand that. you know? And so it's the valuation of that. That's the difference. And like, if you're coming from that, then you're engaging completely different. It's a different paradigm than if you're engaging like this. That doesn't mean that you're not tapping into funding later on or whatever to have an expanded operation or scale, et cetera, but you've already set the tone. You've already set it.
Yeah, your mindset is different.
Yeah, the model is set. And this is how, if you want to engage with us, it's like this. And this is how we, and, you know, and this is, this, it's viable because of these things, because of these ways and how we connect. And then it becomes really, really attractive because, you know, it's solidified in that way.
Well, there's so many. I mean, I really feel like we need a part two. I'm just going to say. So we're coming up on time. I think, Melissa, maybe you have some final questions. I know there's several projects looming. We didn't even really get it too much into the model. I mean, I think there's more rather to say, let me put it that way, about, you know, education and your interest there. And yeah, some of the just the basic horticultural questions. What do you like to grow? What do you see Reborn growing? And how you would, you know, where are the crops going after you grow them? So I don't know if there's anything you want to touch on there. But yeah, Melissa, do you have sort of final questions for Henry? Final thoughts?
No, I don't think so. I'm just going to like sit and think about, you know, just see certain words, like thinking about currency, value, privilege. Just see certain words and the meanings of them within the world, within like the world of urban agriculture, but the world in general and within New York City and within certain neighborhoods, and specifically community. So I think I'm just going to like sit and kind of think about all of that for a while.
Yeah. Man, sorry. I didn't mean to, this is like this conversation. I feel like we could do a whole other episode on like social theory that I feel like, Henry, you're touching on, the gift economy, or Fred Moten talking about laying in the cut, like being prepared for the commons, developing the commons where you don't know when you're going to need what exactly, but it's more important to have those social foundations, which is very different than a business where you're starting with the pro forma with how much you're going to sell each piece of lettuce for, et cetera.
Well, and
it's,
also
it's just this mindset. Yeah.
Yeah. And this idea of I'm always in this forefront of, cause I feel like a lot of us think about like climate change and adaptation and all of these things that are happening, and like with COVID and the fallout of restaurants and all of this stuff that's
going back to basics,
you know, and it's just, okay, how are we going to, I mean, this is drastic, but survive. Like, how are we going to survive? Yeah. I was just watching, what is that movie?
Interstellar. Sorry,
Interstellar.
Yes.
I just watched Interstellar.
I was thinking
with Niagara
Beastie Boys,
Falls, so. but just like, how are we going to, with all of these things that have always been there, right? There's just new looming things, but the strength within, within all of this, within, you know, these things that have been within communities for centuries and thousands of years and all this other stuff.
Yeah, the resilience of the commons, and how do you bring it in such a cutthroat market as New York, where that's not privileged by institutions. It's not, people don't have this language. So you're in a way having to teach, I'm guessing, a lot of folks, right? I see you're not.
Yeah. I mean, that's been, I feel like that's been my job. It's gotten better post-COVID because people kind of like, before people would look at me like I was crazy. I would talk to them about these systems and all these things and scaling and what we're thinking. And they would just be like, what are you talking about?
Yeah. Like, now what are you selling? Like, yeah.
Perspective shift.
Now it's like, yeah.
Shift.
When, where, why, how? Yeah. Like, it's a shift. And then to your point about just, you know, the climate and all of these things, it's forcing other people to find new ways forward, right? Certain communities have always had it. It's just never been, because there's a dominant narrative or a dominant culture that in many ways does not allow for certain voices or certain customs, et cetera, because they're not viable within the dominant culture. But what you're now starting to see is that the dominant culture is collapsing. Yeah. These ideas are collapsing. And they're all resorting to these things and these other components or ideas that were not incentivized or not even thought of as viable. Or reduced to being inferior to other systems and other things because they were very much so, because they were simple.
So I know some of this translates like you want the Bronx to be not just a place where people are thinking about climate change or adapting to climate change, but are really leading this conversation.
Yeah.
And cultural institutions, along with, you know, all these other dimensions of society you've named, can all participate in that story. And that's something that, I know you've put time into thinking about. I do feel like we're going to have to do a part two or something because I think we're basically out of time.
For sure.
Henry, you should have the last word. Is there anything you want to make sure, you know, to kind of
say? Or like new possibilities
or
things.
Yeah. In the spirit of everything that we talked about, I do believe that the Bronx can lead the way because we lead the way in so much culturally. I mean, you know, from the ashes, creating hip hop and the world now, it's I would say the heartbeat of the world. Whether it's language, whether it's dressing, whether it's fashion, dance, whether it's music, it's the Bronx identity that is now a global identity. And you know, it's not just that, but also in food and in tradition. We've led in so many ways that I do believe that this next stage, and specifically a lot of things that we're planning when it comes to climate, when it comes to the built environment, when it comes to cities, when it comes to communities and urban spaces, I do believe that the Bronx can lead the way because it's been in a specific position to do that by way of the resiliency, but also because it offers a stark reality to how things were, to how things can be. And one of these things that I want to mention is an opportunity that's coming up, which, you know, many of the public may know, but this idea of creating an economic engine or ideas of transformation have now been thought of in the Bronx by way of infrastructure and thinking about, for example, the Kingsbridge Armory. That is, you know, it's the largest armory in the world. It's been sitting empty for the last 30 years. It's close to like 600,000 square feet. It's a massive, massive space that can accommodate the future and transform the Bronx. And this future can be, I would say, focused around many of the things we talked about, whether it's agriculture or sustainable ideas or pipelines, et cetera. And we believe that that is an opportunity to for the Bronx, for the community, and the stakeholders there. And so we are in support of that, and we're championing for community organizations to also partner with us as we are part of this group that envisions a way forward for this building and communities. Our group is called the Reborn Community Alliance, and it is from this space of community and engagement that we are looking to find solutions around climate mitigation, around hyperlocal food production at scale, et cetera. So, yeah, I'll put it out there for your audience to definitely have that on their minds and think about ways that possibly we can partner and make this a reality and be the global reference for cities.
Excellent, excellent. Yeah, and it's an amazing opportunity. I mean, how often in the heart of a dense urban metropolis do you just have a space as big as the Garden Order or an airport just sitting there, unused for half a century? It's an immaculate, giant building. They're really next to a bunch of colleges, housing. I mean, you know, it's a very vibrant neighborhood. It's not at all a dead area. It just has this big building in the middle of it, surrounded by trees, and I think that's a really interesting topic that we should have you on to discuss more, some other specific projects, and check in with you once the Reborn Farm site in Morsania is up and running, the rooftop we mentioned. So, Henry, thank you so much for being on. We didn't even get to ask what your favorite pizza is in the city, which we could always ask.
But how could people find out more the projects that you're working on yeah. Reborn? How could, you know?
I'd love to hear from the audience. You can definitely reach me at Henry Obispo on LinkedIn, or Reborn Farms, also on LinkedIn, as well as Instagram under Sustainable Poppy.
Nice.
Yes, I own that. fully own that. And also Reborn Farms on IG, as well as the website, RebornFarms.com. And just in general, you know, holler at me wherever you see me, or by way of friends or whomever you're connected with that I may know also. I would love to be in conversation with all of you.
Well, we'll put show notes. We'll have links. That's the word I was trying to say. We'll put the links in the show notes. Thank you so much, Henry Obispo, for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
Yeah, thank you so much.
My great pleasure. Thank you for having me.
This has been Fields. Happy planting.
Fields is powered by Riverside. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradio.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork.
Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage, and thanks for listening.
Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Latham.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.